This is the open session. You yes. understand that?
Yes. May it please the court, Anne Murphy for the government. Your Honours, the government in this case put in more than a preponderance of the evidence that showed that Mr. Al-Adahi was properly held under the authorization for the use of military force.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear understand what you said. What?
That the government's evidence in the district court, Your Honour, more than satisfied a proper preponderance of the evidence standard. And that the reason that the court nonetheless ordered Mr. Al-Adahi released back to Yemen were twofold. First of all, the court improperly narrowed the government's detention authority, and secondly, the district court imposed a series of evidentiary standards upon the government that went far beyond the preponderance of the evidence standard. Your Honor, the government put on evidence that Mr. Al-Adahi...
Why should the government have to establish by a preponderance of the evidence? Where does that come from, aside from Judge Hogan's order?
Your Honor,
it doesn't come from Boumediene.
It doesn't come from Boumediene, but Boumediene committed to the courts, the trial courts, and this court, obviously, since all the cases are in the circuit. The Supreme Court left it to the courts to determine both the substantive and procedural standards under which these cases would be decided.
I must admit, I mean, I'm not charging you with generating confusion, but I am very confused by this whole state of affairs. If the habeas corpus that was suspended is the writ as it existed in 1789, which is what St. Cyr suggested, right, then whatever the procedures were from that, the writ as it existed in 1789 is all that the detainees are entitled to. Otherwise, I don't know where this stuff comes from. And the writ as it existed in 1789 did not require the government to put on a preponderance of the evidence standard. It required a return. That's it. Jurisdiction.
Well, Your Honor,
And up until fairly recently, in the immigration dealing with aliens, the Supreme Court acknowledges in St. Cyr the only thing that was required was some evidence.
Your Honor, in this case, we haven't appealed on that aspect of the court's ruling. We've accepted the burden of needing to prove the propriety of the detention by a preponderance. That's where we are. And our position in this appeal is simply that the government's evidence was really compelling in this case, that Mr. Al-Adahi was part of Al-Qaeda when he was detained, and that the district court's ruling, which imposed so many more burdens and the higher standard on the government, has to be reversed because this isn't the way that the cases should be handled. Your Honor, there's ample evidence here that Mr. Al-Adahi was part of Al-Qaeda, but when he was in Yemen, that he traveled from Yemen to Afghanistan, that Al-Qaeda paid for his travel and arranged it. That's at pages 398 to 399 of your joint appendix. That he had a personal, private conversation with Osama bin Laden about the jihad in Yemen, and that's at page 553 to 554, where Al-Adahi says that he spoke with Osama bin Laden about Yemeni chiefs. That he attended a training camp, a terrorist training camp, that on the way he went to the guest house that was the staging guest house for the training camp, that when he left the training camp, he went back to the Al-Qaeda compound that he come from, and then we have evidence that we'll discuss in the closed session that further confirms that as he traveled around Afghanistan after the United States started Operation Enduring Freedom, he was not there as a tourist, as he suggested, but was and was not fleeing to the border, as the district court held, but in fact was moving away from the border crossing. On the other side of the balance, which the district court basically didn't look at, because the district court said the government has the burden, the detainee doesn't have to prove anything. I mean, to your point, Your Honor, that's certainly wrong, that even under preponderance standard, that there's no need to look at what the detainee says. So the court never got to the point of saying under which version of the story is more likely to be true. It simply said the government hasn't carried its burden. And the reasons the court gave for concluding that the government hadn't carried its burden were erroneous or clearly erroneous, depending whether they're the factual components or the legal components. First of all, there are two issues relating to the detention standard. The district court appeared to believe that in order to be detainable under the authorization for the use of military force, Mr. Al-Adahi had to be actually part of a fighting band and unit at the time he was captured. We know that's not right. Al-Bahani tells us that's not right. Al-Bahani was a cook. And in any event, you know, the Partov standard does not require that the detainee be actively engaged in fighting at the time of capture. The district court also faulted the government for failing to show that in addition to all the activities involving Al-Qaeda, the terror training, the living in basically a guest house and staying in Afghanistan during the war, that the government also had to separately and independently prove that Mr. Al-Adahi endorsed Al-Qaeda and embraced its terrorist philosophies. And that was mistaken. The district court also held the government to a number of wrong standards of proof. It required compelling evidence of certain facts. It faulted the government for failing to provide direct evidence or affirmative evidence of certain things. And it never did look, as I say, at the totality of the evidence. It just took the different pieces of the government's evidence, didn't look at the rest of the evidence when it was drawing inferences, and basically misapplied the preponderance standard. And as you know, we've asked you to reverse on the basis of clear error for the factual findings, because the government's evidence really can't be treated that way in these proceedings. So there's really one part of the petitioner's objections to the proceeding that we would like to deal with, and that's their argument that the federal rules of evidence apply in these cases. That's mistaken. This court in Kiemba, in the Kiemba case, pointed out that these were now statutory habeas cases under 2241. But we'd like to point out that 2241 is only a grant of jurisdiction, and it doesn't speak to the procedures that are necessary in the habeas cases. Congress made its intentions extremely clear on what the procedure should be. It is twice held in the Detainee Treatment Act and the Military Commissions Act that there should be no habeas procedures at all. So in our view, that satisfies the requirement of the federal rules that Congress specify for procedures elsewhere. So even if these are 2241 statutory procedures, that's just a grant of jurisdiction to the court to grant the writ, and it doesn't speak to the procedures that have to be used. The Supreme Court's been very clear, both in Hamdi and Boumediene, and of course this court in Al-Bahani now, that the procedures are not these are entirely different class of cases, and so we don't need to look at criminal procedure or other habeas procedures as a baseline. And we simply need to confirm to the directions that the Supreme Court has given. And as we pointed out in our brief, all of the requirements that the Supreme Court has put in place, that there be a neutral decision maker, that there be ability to look at the facts, that their ability to put on exculpatory evidence for the petitioner, they're all entirely satisfied by the case management order here. And I'd just also like to point out that Al-Bahani was completely right in saying that if you want to have meaningful procedures, which Boumediene says we must, in these cases where the evidence is basically military intelligence evidence, that's what the court's going to have to look at, and it's going to have to do more than just get itself into a procedural morass by trying to apply the evidence rules. It needs to actually look to the evidence and address it. Well, Your Honors, if you have no questions on the case, I think.
I was just looking up some. The petitioner raises the Geneva Convention.
Yes, Your Honor.
Third Geneva Convention. I haven't looked at it, but my memory was that was it the Detainee Treatment Act or the Military Commission Act?
Section 5 of the Military Commission Act.
Or said that the Geneva Conventions are not enforceable with respect to Guantanamo detainees.
Section 5 of the Military Commissions Act says that the
Geneva Convention. That ends that argument, unless that's unconstitutional.
No, we entirely agree with you, Your Honor. But there are other reasons why the Geneva Conventions don't apply.
Right? You argued that it wasn't.
There's no exclusionary rule. He's not a prisoner of war, even though he argues that he is. There's a number of reasons. But you're correct that Congress has also precluded the use of the Geneva Convention.
You didn't argue that, though, did you?
Yes, Your Honor.
Oh, you did?
Yes. It's kind of, yes, it wasn't our lead-off argument.
Okay.
We had a large number on that.
But in a military commission, what's the government's burden of proof?
I'm not sure of the answer to that question, but we don't know, Your Honor, but this, I mean, yeah.
It's not beyond a reasonable doubt. I'm fairly certain of that. I couldn't remember whether it's clear and convincing or...
I don't want to give you an incorrect answer, so we'll make sure that we provide you an answer that is correct after the argument. I'll reserve the balance of my time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chandler.
May it please this court, I'm John Chandler. I represent Muhammad Al-Adahi here. I want to thank this court first for expediting this appeal. Muhammad Al-Adahi is beginning his ninth year in Guantanamo, having been found by the district court to having been held illegally. Muhammad Al-Adahi is a 47-year-old man who left Yemen at age 40. He had never been involved in any terrorist activities of any sort in Yemen. He worked for 20...
How can he have left Yemen at the age of 40 and now be 47 and yet be held at Guantanamo for 9 years? How can that possibly be?
I was pulling that from the record, Your Honor. He has been in Guantanamo 8 years, starting his ninth year. When he testified last summer, he said he was 47 years old. So he must have left Yemen at age 39 or 40. And that makes it work just about right. And I'm sorry, I was just pulling from the record on that. Mr. Al-Adahi worked for 20 years for the Yemen Oil Company, steady employment. He took a six-month leave of absence to take his sister to her new husband in Afghanistan. In that part of the world, women don't travel by themselves. So he took her to Afghanistan. The six-month leave of absence that he obtained from the Yemen Oil Company is not anything unusual. He testified that when he got there, he was going to make sure that she was okay or bring her back home. He went to Afghanistan after July 1st, 2001. Now, the district court judge in these circumstances heard all of the evidence and determined, considering all of the evidence, every fact raised by the government was admitted into evidence and was weighed by the district court judge. And as this court is well aware, you can only reverse the district court judge on this point if you find that her decision was clearly erroneous. The fact is that she had direct testimony that he was not a member of Al-Qaeda or the Taliban or supporting
He goes to Afghanistan in the summer of 2001, July, you said?
July, after July 1st, 2001. Yes, Your Honor.
And then he enlists in the Al-Qaeda training camp.
No, Your Honor. He goes to Al-Farouq training camp for 7 to 10 days. There's no suggestion that
now,
he...
When was that? Was that July or August?
As best as we can piece it together, from going to the wedding to some time, it must have been early August of 2001. He stayed there 7 to 10 days.
That has nothing to do with escorting his sister to get married, though. He can't be escorting her if he's in an Al-Qaeda training camp, right?
Well, he had escorted her. He had gone to the wedding celebration. She was then with her husband. He said that he was going to stay there until he saw that she was okay. Certainly his going to Al-Farouq for 7 to 10 days is not looking after his sister at that point. But there's nothing to suggest that he enlisted in Al-Farouq or in Al-Qaeda. And indeed, the evidence is directly to the contrary. He refused to follow the rules.
One of the problems that I see, and I'll let you address this, with the way that Judge Kessler analyzed this case is that we can talk about totality of the circumstances, which is a phrase that I think carries no meaning.
You always look at the totality of the circumstances, whatever that means.
I agree.
But what it seems to me that Judge Kessler failed to appreciate is conditional probability analysis. And for example, what you don't do in assessing probability, which is what preponderance of the evidence means, is you don't look at one fact and say, well, that doesn't prove it, and you throw it in the waste can. You look at the next, that doesn't prove it, and you throw that in the waste can. What you do is you accumulate the evidence. The fact that your client was in Afghanistan, that doesn't prove he was with Al-Qaeda. The fact that he was in a section of Afghanistan where Osama bin Laden held sway, that doesn't prove it either. The fact that he went to an Al-Qaeda training camp, the fact that he remained, the fact that somebody said this and that, you put it all together, and then now you've got a case. You know, but what she did, what Judge Kessler did, with all respect, it seems to me, is to take each one of these little pieces of evidence, some of them are not so little, and look at them and say, this doesn't prove it, and throw it away.
I just disagree with you completely, Your Honor. She says that that's not what she did. The parties agreed that there were going to be six sets of facts considered. That's the way the case was tried for 4 days. And Judge Kessler heard arguments about this for 4 days. She heard it as to each piece. She didn't exclude anything. And at the end of her opinion, she pulls it all together. She considers each of the six factors and says, when you put them together, do I reach the conclusion that he was a member of or supporting Al-Qaeda? By the way, the suggestion that he had to be fighting with Al-Qaeda is belied by her decision. She says at the end of it, considering all of these facts, is there evidence sufficient for me to conclude by a preponderance, the standard the government asked for and got? Is there enough evidence for me to conclude that he is a member of Al-Qaeda or supporting Al-Qaeda or the Taliban? She found not. There is direct evidence that he is not. There is only circumstantial evidence that he is, with the exception of one man who is not believable.
In law, maybe there was in 1789, but there's certainly no difference today between circumstantial and direct evidence.
The difference between circumstantial and direct evidence is important here, Judge Kavanaugh. Direct evidence, he says, I am not a member of Al-Qaeda. That is direct evidence. He went to Al-Farouk. From that circumstantial evidence, you can draw two conclusions. You can draw two inferences. One inference is that he was a member of Al-Qaeda. The other is that because he did not follow the rules and got kicked out, that he was not a member of Al-Qaeda. The Supreme Court says in Anderson versus City of Bessemer that if there are two inferences, that the inference she draws cannot be clearly erroneous. So there is a difference between direct and circumstantial.
I'm reminded of the old saw, you know, the one about the snow?
Absolutely.
If you go to sleep at night and it's not snowing, you wake up, as we have, the next morning, and there's 2 feet of snow on the ground, and it's not snowing. That's circumstantial evidence that it snowed, right?
I have spent a lovely week with you and noticed that. I agree with you. Circumstantial evidence is perfectly capable of proving a case, and that's not my argument, Your Honor. My argument is that from that circumstantial evidence, two inferences can be drawn, or three or four. And if the trial judge sitting alone draws an inference and another is permissible, you cannot find
that it's clearly
erroneous.
What's your argument that the standard of proof should be preponderance, or should be whatever it is? I don't know. What's your argument? Where do you get that from?
Well, where I got it from was from the United States government, who made that argument. I would also suggest...
Do you have any independent argument for that?
I do have an independent argument. My independent argument is it should be clear and convincing proof, and my argument from that would really
draw... Let me give you a hypothetical. Yes. I'm going to simplify things. It's 1789, right? And The government arrests somebody. The federal government, assume there were federal crimes, arrests somebody. Now, and in compliance with the Fourth Amendment, which requires what? Probable cause.
Probable right? cause.
The individual immediately files a petition for a writ of habeas corpus, and it winds up before a federal district judge, assuming that one was existing at that time. And the district judge says, oh, well, wait a minute. You only got probable cause for this guy. I'm going to release him because you have to prove beyond a preponderance of the evidence that he's guilty. And all you've got is probable cause. Now, that system would make no sense whatsoever. Oh,
I perhaps agree with you on that. I have had the pleasure of reading some of the habeas decisions from my state, the state of Georgia, prior to the adoption of our Constitution. And there are civil habeas decisions. I wish I could call the name of it right this moment. It's a man on a ship outside of Savannah who files a petition for habeas corpus saying that he is being improperly held. And while the court does not say that it's applying a preponderance standard, it seems to be the case. But today, Your Honor, we're talking about I'd love to find that case and send it to you. Today we're talking about men being held for 9 years. The only analogy outside of the criminal law is involuntary detention under the civil laws. For instance, the sexual abuse cases where a man's been convicted of sexual abuse.
And you can be held for many years under those laws.
That's correct. And the standard of proof, according to the United States Supreme Court, is clear and convincing evidence mm-hmm. under Addington versus Texas. Mm-hmm. And that's...
What about immigration? I mean, if somebody comes into the United States trying to get admitted and they're turned away. But they're not deported, and they file a petition for a writ of habeas corpus. And what is the standard then? What was the standard then until about... whenever, I don't know, not very long ago. That's the St. Cyr case. It's not a preponderance, just you have to have some evidence.
That's correct. There had to be some evidence.
One guy that was stopped at Ellis Island, at the Meze case, that remained right. there for years
remained
and years
there
and years.
For years. Right. The difference here is that Mr. Al-Adahi was arrested in Pakistan, not on a battlefield. There is no battlefield evidence here of any sort. Was arrested in Pakistan with his passport and his airline tickets to go home. If he were caught in immigration today, he would say, fine, let me take my airline ticket and go home. Immigration, supposedly, is to send men back home or find a place to send them to. So that seems to me to be distinct from holding men in a prison involuntarily for 9 years.
Has he been scheduled for a military commission trial?
He has not. We have gone through the Obama administration tells us that it has gone through its process of sorting out who is and who has not. He has not been scheduled for a military commission, and I don't think there's any chance that he will be, Your Honor. This is a man who...
Of course, the theory of...
What basis do you make that, Judge?
Go ahead.
The basis I believe that for is that the man spent 7 to 10 days at Al-Farouk as the worst evidence against him and got kicked out without question for not following the rules, not following the command structure. There's no suggestion except for the furthest reach of an inference that he ever picked up arms against anybody while he was in Afghanistan. It's not a case that would be tried. Excuse me.
Well, the Al-Bahani case suggests that being in a training camp itself is sufficient to justify detention. You want to respond to that?
Yes, Your Honor. You were on that panel, and I hesitate to tell you what the decision said. I don't read that as saying that being at Al-Farouk is sufficient. I read it as saying that that's one of the factors, and it may be enough. Our record shows that Being at Al-Farouk is about a 8-week process, if you look at one of our last exhibits. This guy was there for 7 to 10 days. We are not challenging here the government's view of its detention authority. There's no legal question here before you on that. For the purposes of this case, we'll accept it. If he were a member of Al-Qaeda, he could be held. If he were a member of Taliban.
Well, the problem is, and this is obvious, but the problem is determining whether someone's a member of Al-Qaeda is a lot different than determining whether someone's a member of an armed force. And you've been, and I understand this, criticizing the use of inference and circumstantial evidence, but that's going to be the name of the game in most cases, isn't it?
Well,
and isn't that the concern that the September 11th Commission report raised about what had gone on before September 11th, that there was a failure to draw inferences, to make connections based on circumstantial evidence?
Absolutely, Your Honor, and I'm not criticizing drawing inferences. I'm saying that we've got a federal district judge who sat there for 4 days and looked at all of this evidence and heard arguments for 4 days. We're arguing before you for 40 minutes. She listened to this for 4 days, and she concluded as a fact, that he was neither a member of Al-Qaeda nor Taliban nor supported Al-Qaeda nor the Taliban. You have to find that factual finding is clearly erroneous. We don't, you know, I know the opinions you've written, Judge Kavanaugh. The Supreme Court says, however, that we get habeas.
I'm Judge Randolph.
I know you're Judge Randolph. I'm sorry. I got wound up, Judge Randolph. I'm sorry. Will you forgive me? And Judge Kavanaugh, will you forgive me?
I'm honored by the comparison.
And I'm humiliated at my getting so wound up.
Do you know the old story here when Judge Bork and Judge Scalia were on the court here? An attorney, like in your position, kept referring to Judge Scalia as Judge Scalia. Yes, Judge Scalia. No, Judge Scalia. And finally, Judge Bork interrupted him and says, "Counsel, it's Scalia, not Scalia." And now Justice Scalia said, "Thank you, Judge Bork."
Well, I shan't try to make a joke. What I will do instead, Judge Randolph, is say that in Bemidji in the Supreme Court and Rasul, the Supreme Court says these men get to petition for habeas. There are 188 of them coming along. The government appealed another one last Friday. Our federal district judges, according to the court in Bemidian, according to the court in Anderson versus City of Bessemer, our federal district judges are the ones who are well equipped to sit there. Judge Kessler has been a trial judge since 1977. She is a person whose expertise is in finding facts. She sat there, she listened to this. And under the system we've got today, the federal district judge is going to make the decision. Obviously, you're here to correct error, but she and those other judges are going to make the decision. I don't think you want to be in the business of revisiting the factual determinations in 188 cases. I think that when a federal district judge applies the burden of proof that the government asked for, and the judge does that, and clearly Judge Kessler did. If I could quote Al-Bahani on the petitioner's claim that judge didn't follow apply the proper burden of proof, I would. You guys just dismissed it and says nothing further is needed. She said four times she did. But if the proper burden is applied, and if the federal district judge makes the factual determination, then I would suggest to you that this court, even if you would come to a different conclusion, even if you wish that you had been the federal judge sitting there, under Anderson versus City of Bessemer, you may not reverse the decision. Judge Henderson.
What deference should the district court give to the government? The argument you just made was a very interesting spin of giving deference to district courts. Shouldn't the district courts in turn give substantial deference to the government? After all, the government's the one in the best position to know whether someone needs to be preventively detained as a potential threat to the United States.
Judge Kavanaugh, I've given a lot of thought to that. Perhaps if the government had brought in an expert to say that I've looked at all of this and I have determined from looking at all the evidence that he is al-Qaeda, perhaps. There's nothing in the Supreme Court decisions, however, that suggests that they are entitled to deference. One of, I think, in Hamdi, maybe Justice O'Connor suggested that was a possibility, but it's not something from which the government has appealed here.
There are going to be some cases, of course, where you end up saying, after looking at the evidence, maybe, maybe not. And this really goes to Judge Randolph's point about the burden of proof. I mean, in a maybe, maybe not scenario, a lot of the post 9/11 reports and studies and government actions were to connect the dots, to hold people in those circumstances. Now, I understand your point about how long it's going on, and that certainly is what makes this much more difficult. But
yes, sir. I agree with you.
Poses and a great problem.
But I do think that our district court judges are best equipped to hear 4 full days of evidence, watch this man testify, make credibility determinations. You know, they said in their main brief, page 25, that she credited his testimony about al-Farouq. This man, she looked at him. She assessed him. She is the one who's best able to do that, and I apologize for running over.
All right, thank you. How much time does the government have? All right. Do you want to take 2 minutes, and then we'll go into closed session, if you need it?
Just quickly, Mr. Chandler asked you not to review the district court's factual findings on the theory that there are many of these cases. That's one of the reasons that the government took the appeal, because we very well know that as an appellate court, it's not normal to review a judge's factual findings. But for exactly the reason you gave Judge Randolph, the divide and conquer approach to the evidence in this case is just inappropriate, and it's very important to us that you do review the judge's factual findings here. On the question of whether going to a training camp is only enough, in this case, there's so much more, which, of course, I'll talk about in the closed session. But there's all kinds of evidence, as well as the training camp evidence. He didn't leave Afghanistan during the bombing campaign. He didn't cross the border and go back to Yemen. He stayed behind. He was very closely interlinked and positioned with the al-Qaeda leadership, senior al-Qaeda leadership. And on the question of deference to the government, we did ask in our briefs, and we asked the district court for deference to at least the military expert declarations on the significance of training camps and guest houses and those types of evidence. And that, too, is important, a certain degree of deference to the military and understanding of the military context. Whereas here, the district court said, because of the military context, the record's going to be incomplete. And what the district court did on that basis was to draw all the inferences against the government on a theory that the government had the burden of proof, and that's not appropriate.
Is it clear that government that the burden is on the government as opposed to the petitioner? In a usual habeas corpus case, isn't it the petitioner who has to establish the illegality of the detention? I'm talking modern now. I'm not talking...
Not 1789. Normally, yes, it is the petitioner's burden, but in this case, Your Honor, the case management order that was litigated and hashed out in the district court, the government accepted the burden of being required to prove by a preponderance. And our issue on appeal is simply that the district court did not apply a preponderance standard. It applied a very much higher standard. And as you say, it just looked at the little pieces of evidence one at a time and never sewed them together into the whole story. Thank you, Alice.
All right, thank you. We'll take a brief recess and then return to closed session.